Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
State Treasurer David McRae is returning record amounts of money to Mississippians, whether it's through the College and Career Savings Program or the hundreds of millions in unclaimed money awaiting your claim. Treasurer David McRae says get your applications and claims in today. Treasury.ms.gov.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. And it is Thanksgiving week there, Rhino.
Howdy, howdy.
A little short one in store for us. I know a lot of folks probably enjoying the entire week. I know some folks that are out and about on vacation. And you can tell by the parking lot, right?
Yeah, it's not quite COVID empty, but it's definitely getting towards holiday empty.
COVID empty. Gotcha. Yeah. Don't miss those days when you had to come in and get your temperature taken, right, before you could even get through the building here.
That was so dumb.
I would say that it kind of extended on a little bit beyond where it needed to at a
little
minimum.
Bit.
A little bit. Yeah.
We had, what, 72 weeks of 2 weeks to flatten the curve?
Man, oh, man. Well, it's been a busy weekend as the president-elect has certainly been quite busy making appointments, naming more folks into his inner circle there in his cabinet and in other positions in the federal government. As well, I mean, really just all over it, isn't he? It's amazing. The situation, I guess, with the health picks, those that are involved in the agencies that deal with public health. We got an FDA. You don't really think about how sprawling is this bureaucracy until you see all these people that are getting selected to run these various groups. But we have an FDA. Well, let's start at the top. We got Health and Human Services. That's Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. And then underneath that, we've got CMS. That's the folks that run Medicare and Medicaid. That would be Dr. Mehmet Oz. And then we got the FDA. Then we got the CDC. And then we got the Surgeon General. You think we're covered?
And just a little heads up, if you think that sounds sprawling.
Yeah.
Every time there is a new president, the president has to fill out what is known as the plum book.
Okay.
And the plum book contains something like 4,300 positions.
Jeez.
That have to be filled. And the majority of them are just, all right, you there, you there, you there. Some of them have to be approved by the Senate, but the vast majority are just, all right, you look like the right person for the job. But, yeah, it's 4,300, if I'm not mistaken, positions that have to be filled. And for historical context, the reason it's called the plum book is because for the largest portion of our country's history, it really was. It was a published, not published, well, I guess published is the right term when it's manufactured by a publisher.
Okay.
But it was a little book. That was colored plum to differentiate it from the other books.
So we had, that's how it was identified, in other words, based
the
on
plum book?
Its color.
Well, those little weird nuances of federal governance.
Well, the Federal Reserve Board issues what's called the beige book, by the way. Similar situation, I'm quite sure.
But what's the What's the other one? The Big Red Book? Was that the DOD security standard or something like that?
Yep.
Or you were a really cool hacker back in the 90s if you got the Big Red Ugly Book that cost you $60. You just had to mail off and get it.
So let's just continue on with these health care appointments. HHS. And then we got CMS. That's Mehmet Oz. We got Dr. Marty McCary. He is FDA. And then we've got CDC. That's Dr. Dave Weldon. He's a former rep from the state of Florida. Served in the House from 1995 to 2009. Dr. Jeanette Neshwat for Surgeon General. Did I get them all? Let's see. HHS, CMS, FDA, CDC, and Surgeon General. Now, there's one thing that's developing as a pattern here. Is anybody going to be left over there at Fox News? It looks like that the president-elect is selecting a lot of folks to serve in these positions that are regular contributors. One of them, the Department of Defense Secretary, even a host. So here's what's different.
I was wrong.
What's that?
I don't know the official numbers on the newest Plum Book, but the 2020 Plum Book.
Yeah.
7,935 political appointments.
Insanity. That's insanity. That's, I think, indicative of what's wrong in our country with respect to the federal government. There's no doubt about that. Now, one of the appointments, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, may be the one that disturbs me more than any. And not that I'm too terribly bent out of shape on the appointments. But this one in particular, I think folks ought to know about. And that's the Labor Secretary. I'm not sure where this one came from. But it is a concern. And that's Representative Lori Chavez de Rimmer. I think I said that right. This is another one of those reps of the 435 in the House you don't know anything about. I mean, it's a situation where most people in this country don't know who's serving in the U.S. House as it is. Most don't even know who's in the Senate. But there ain't but 100 of them. But in the House, there's 435. But the Labor Secretary, have you ever heard of this person before, Rhino? Lori Chavez de Rimmer? And let's be honest, unless they're in the news somehow, they're in a faraway state, which is the case here. She's from Oregon. We just wouldn't know who they are. And they're not one of these people that are just, like I said, always in the news, you know, making a stink, getting attention, which is what they primarily seek to do. She's from a swing district that includes parts of Portland. She's extremely pro-union. And here's what really tipped me off as to, I better look into this person after I heard the appointment. The labor unions, virtually across the board, came out in support of this selection. Then I got nervous, including the teachers' unions, which may be the most egregious in the country. She got more labor union endorsements when she was running, as a matter of fact, than any Republican in the history of the country. So her cozy relationship with labor unions is a cause for concern. But here's probably the biggest cause for concern. And again, I'm open here. I'm not at a point where I'm saying, oh, this is just a doom situation. I'm open to deferring to the president-elect. He and, of course, his inner circle, they selected this individual. I'm willing to give her a chance and to see what happens during the Senate hearings as part of the appointment process when they execute their advise and consent function, does the upper chamber. But this is the thing that bothered me most of all, Rhino. She is one of, I think, three, maybe, Republicans who voted for the PRO Act. That's P-R-O. That's some cute acronym. Not sure exactly what it stands for. All I know
protecting the right to organize.
Okay. Well, that's all you need to know. Thank you. That right off the bat sounds extremely pro-union, but this is something you remember when this was introduced, you and I talked about on the program, would, and I'm exaggerating maybe a tad here, but the goal of the Democrats is to force everybody in this country to be in a labor union. It doesn't really matter what your job is, what your profession is, what your occupation is. The PRO Act would make great strides towards that goal. It would virtually eliminate the so-called gig economy. Uber, that's kind of the job that comes to mind more than anything. I work part-time driving an Uber, right? Pizza delivery, another one. But there is a thriving, robust gig economy in this country. And the Democrats can't stand that. You mean you're doing that independent? You have this contract with a company where you're providing work for them and they're just paying you essentially 1099 pay, which you're then filing on your tax return, but you don't know what you're doing. You can't do that. We got to step in and protect you and make sure you're a full-time employee and you're getting all the benefits that employer offers, even though you just want to drive a car a few hours a week and make a little extra money. That's all you want. You don't want all the hassles associated with being a full-time employee and going to stupid DEI meetings, for example. This bothers me. We're coming right back with Jeremy Nelson, a partner at Element Wealth.
Hey, this is Bob.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. We are again live in the Element Well studio. We're pleased to welcome now Jeremy Nelson, a partner at Element Well. Jeremy, good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
I'm not sure if we talked since the election.
No, I think this is the first time.
I think so, too. Well, of course, very much relevant to your line of work and the economy is a Treasury Secretary. I've been waiting for that one after all the other pieces started to come into place and the puzzle was being populated. But Treasury Secretary, there were a number of names that were kind of in that mix, and the president-elect decided on Scott Bissent. He is he's kind of like you. He's an investor. He manages folks' money, and he knows how to make money for sure. So what do you think?
Yeah, so they say that he's got a pretty good handle on the bond market, which is – I mean, really, if you think about it, one of the biggest things that the Treasury Secretary has to do is the financing of the debt and the country. And so I think that having someone that has that kind of experience is good. I think it's good that we've got someone who is going to be focused on the job and not things that aren't within their purview.
Yeah.
So, we're talking a bit off air how, Janet Yellen – she was an interesting pick, and she seemed to be focused on a lot of stuff that had nothing to do with what the Treasury Secretary was supposed to be doing.
Right.
And so I think here's somebody who's coming in. He talks about a three-pronged approach, right? He talks about driving GDP growth up to 3%. He talks about reducing the deficit to 3% of GDP, which is about half of what it is today. And then he talks about producing more oil to keep inflation down. So now how you get there – is a little bit of a challenge,
yeah.
Right? I mean, we saw in Trump's first administration, we didn't quite get up to that consistent 3% growth. There was a little bit of an uptick from the Obama administration, but we did see some deficits uptick. So it's going to be interesting to see how the policy is formed to hit that 3% growth target, to reduce the deficit as a percentage of GDP down to 3%. But I do think that it is doable, and I think that he's put someone in place here who is going to be focused on that, and I think we'll do a good job.
So just to clarify for the folks, he's proposing what he calls the 333 plan. It so reminded me of the late Herman Cain when he ran for president. Remember his 999 plan, yeah. Remember? Yeah. And this is a 333. And you just discussed the first component of that, that being to pursue 3% GDP growth. And that would be higher than anything we had in the first Trump administration.
Yes.
He had under 2, I think.
Under 2.
Yeah. And, of course, now we're under 2 as well in the Biden administration. So 3% GDP growth, reducing the deficit to be 3% of GDP.
Yes.
And then increasing the output of oil by 3 million barrels a day, mm-hmm. which would be significant, honestly, because we're producing right now about 13. So last I checked, so 13 million, we consume about 19.
It would be a big uptick. Now, it'll take time to get there, and some of it's going to be kind of reversing some of the executive orders and the mandates from the Biden administration so we can get the supply back up and going. But, yeah, I mean, look, long term, I don't know if anyone started watching the Landman on Paramount Plus, but, you know, you start to learn about the oil industry a good bit there and the importance of it. I was watching that last night. But, yeah, it's important that we have that infrastructure with regard and supply with oil, because the reality is, as much as we want to talk about diversifying and going electric and all that kind of stuff, we're not there. We're not even close.
Right.
It's stupid, because all you're doing is setting yourself up for an energy crisis down the road. So, yes, would it be great in the future to have a more diverse energy infrastructure? Absolutely. But you got to realize where we are today, we don't have the transmission for the electricity.
Right.
Right. Wind and solar, it just doesn't produce what oil does.
Yeah. And I think we have Energy Secretary, Interior, with Doug Burgum. I mean, those guys, EPA, they all have to work together. I think they're more friendly to fossil fuels. Certainly, I don't think Trump would have selected them.
No.
Were they not?
No, definitely not.
He made that a marquee, did he not? A marquee promise on the campaign trail. We're going to drill, baby, drill. I mean, you heard it over and over again.
Yeah.
And that was the central theme in his plan to grow the economy. So we have a Treasury Secretary now. Now, just how different is that, just looking through, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, right off the bat? I don't know if you know this or not. She sent out a statement to the department's workers that commitment to values of diversity, equity, inclusion is expected of every employee. I mean, so that's no place in the Department of Treasury, is it?
No, and look, By saying what I'm saying, I'm not saying that, you know, we shouldn't have diversity. We should. And, you know, equity in the sense of the best people for the jobs, right?
Right.
But this mandate to put less qualified people in positions, especially high-level positions within the government that are very important, right? I mean, you would never do this with your business, right? If at Element Wealth, or when you ran your business, if you were like, well, I'm just going to hire people who aren't as good, well, that's a problem. Now, having people that are equally qualified or more qualified and have diverse opinions, that's great, right? Because that creates a better business. But just giving jobs to people because of their gender or race or whatever orientation they want to talk about is silly. And that's not the place of the Treasury Secretary, right?
Right.
The place of the Treasury Secretary is to make sure that the Treasury markets are flowing, that the government is funded, you know, all of those sorts of things, not worrying about these things that have nothing to do with what the Treasury Secretary is supposed to be worried about.
And also, the Treasury Secretary is to serve as a consultant to the president on fiscal policy as well.
Yeah.
Now, the Fed, generally speaking, they don't dip their toe in that. And anytime, you know, Jerome Powell gets asked about that, what do you think about all the radical spending and the $2 trillion deficits? He always says, no, we don't weigh in on fiscal policy.
Yeah. Now they
but the treasurer does.
Now, they have strong opinions, because I remember a few years ago I was on a call with Ben Bernanke, the chairman during the financial crisis. And, you know, he said fiscal policy can only – or monetary policy can only bail out bad fiscal policy for so long.
Right.
Right.
And right.
So – but, you know, the Fed really tries to be apolitical, right? They don't want to be a political lightning rod. They want to kind of do their job, stay out of the limelight as much as possible, which is difficult to do. But you're right. The Treasury Secretary works daily with the president.
Right. Supposed to advise the president on fiscal policy because they're the ones who keep the books, essentially. So.
And you and I have talked about this before. I've talked about with a lot of clients or people who ask me questions about this deficit because people are worried about it, and rightfully so. They should be. I mean, this is a major problem.
Yep.
We've got to the point where it's going to be hard to kick the can down the road much longer.
Yeah.
And I've always said that, look, there's three things that have to happen. You know, one is you need to cut spending because there's a lot of fat that can be cut. Number two is you need to raise some revenue. Number three is you got to grow. Well, if you grow, that's going to raise the revenue, right? And so if you have a focus on the deficit, you say, hey, look, we're going to be pro-growth. We're going to cut regulation. You know, we're going to make it easier on business. That's going to help with inflation. But it's also going to create more growth in the economy, which grows revenue, which means you don't really have to raise taxes as much. And if you cut some spending, all of a sudden, this budget deficit starts to look a lot better.
Yeah. Well, you've got, I think, in Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and now in Bessent, Treasury Secretary, people that believe we got to do something about this deficit. And honestly, you haven't even heard anything about that. Think about it. The last four years, all we got was Joe Biden bragging about how much he cut it from the previous administration, which was all just mathematical gymnastics.
It's a total joke because here's my point. I would say, okay, you stepped in after COVID. So, of course, I mean, if you couldn't cut that deficit, like, you don't belong to be on Earth. At the end of the day, look at what the deficit is today. Look at what it was pre-COVID, and it's double.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's a problem.
We went from pre-COVID, we were about $900 billion. Last year, this past fiscal year, just ended, end of September, $1.8 trillion. No end in sight at this point.
Not even close.
Yeah. We'll come back, talk some more with Jeremy Nelson, partner at Element Wealth. Stay with us.
Listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Rhino always on cue there. Appreciate that, Rhino. So, the markets, Jeremy, we got Jeremy Nelson, partner at Element Wealth. They seem to be responding positively to this naming of Scott Bessent to be the Secretary of Treasury. They like it because, well, first of all, he's a pro-business guy, right? He has experience investing money, doing pretty well at it, making money. He's already announced his 333 plan. He's pro-fossil fuels. He's pro-economic growth. Janet Yellen never talked about economic growth.
No, she didn't. And again, that's the job of the Treasury Secretary,
right?
is to consult on fiscal policy and make sure that the lubrication of the financial system in conjunction with the Fed is
and
working.
Which includes tax policy.
Revenue, yep.
Yeah.
And so I just fundamentally think that it's great to have somebody who's laying out a well-founded plan, right, that actually makes sense, that addresses growth, that addresses the deficit. He recognizes the issue. He recognizes the inflation and that we need more oil production in order to bring that down. So, yeah, I mean, kudos to President Trump on this one.
I think it's a good selection. So what folks want to know is, especially people that are looking at buying a house, what's your outlook? What's your crystal ball say about interest rates, for example?
So we're already seeing, you know, a little bit of softening in mortgage rates right now. Not enough. You're going to need – so two things have to happen. One is the 10-year Treasury needs to come down some. It's not going to go down so much that you're going back to 3% mortgages for 30 years. So just let's kind of get that
off the table. That would require a 1% Fed funds rate.
So what you're likely to see is that I do believe that you're going to see softening in longer-term rates, especially if you've got – a government that is focused on bringing the inflation down. So I think you could see the 10-year Treasury ultimately settling down in that 3.5% range, maybe a percent lower than it is today.
Well, that would get us to 5% mortgage rate.
So then you should, but then you have to get the spread down. What really happened was the spread between the Treasury and the 30-year mortgage really ballooned, and that's what's coming in right now.
Yeah.
And so as that continues to come, I think that we will get to a point where we'll have a five handle, like 5 point something, within the next couple of years. And look, any of our listeners who bought a house in the 80s fully understand, you know, if you can get a 5.5% mortgage, that's not a bad deal.
I bought one in 81.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I told you I stayed in, stood in line all night down in Louisiana, the state of Louisiana, flush with cash at the time, trying to stimulate the housing industry. They went and sold bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And those bonds essentially used to capitalize mortgages, and they allocated a certain amount of those out to all the mortgage lenders in the state. And I stood in line all night, State National Life Insurance, I remember it, headquartered in downtown Baton Rouge, was in the mortgage business as well. And that was to get 10.75%.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I remember my first one. I think this was back in 04, and it was 6.75% or something like that. And
yeah.
It was what it was. People have just become so accustomed to these ultra low rates. I do not see us going back there. But, you know, if you're sitting on one of these mortgages, anytime, generally speaking, you can cut 0.5% or for sure 1% off the rate, it makes sense to refinance.
But I think the problem is it's a little different than when I bought my first house at 10.75% interest, which, by the way, there was 17% was mm-hmm. the prevailing interest rate at the time. You had to be a first-time home buyer and make less than $30,000 a year. My wife and I easily met that standard. I think we made about half of that. But what I'm saying is we've experienced a dramatic increase in the price of housing. So that's a double whammy.
That's kind of the real challenge here, right, is that housing prices they shot up after COVID. And mortgage rates were super low, and there was just a huge demand. What's been interesting is that even as interest rates went up and affordability became less, the prices really held in there and have stayed elevated. They really stopped going up. We're turning a little bit more into a buyer's market now. You don't have to overbid everything like you did a couple of years ago. But the prices have stayed up, and you know, people aren't selling for, you know, a significantly reduced amount right now.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about inflation. Where do you – I mean, the Fed's target is 2%. We're 2.6%, the last reading. They really like to pay attention to the CPE, the consumer expenditures. So what do you think?
I think that we're on a trajectory where if they were rounding, they could round down to 2. I think that it's going to be hard to go below that. Couple things, right? One, if we're talking about tariffs – tariffs are going to be somewhat inflationary, right? So that'll be part of it. We did see in President Trump's first term a bit of an increase in the deficit, in the trade deficit, even after he enacted some of those tariffs on China.
Yeah.
So I think that there's this last little bit of inflation that's going to be hard to get rid of. think that the wealthy still have a lot of money and are continuing to spend. And I think that corporations have really held prices, right? That's why if you look at corporate earnings, they've held prices. They're making money, right? And so I think that the last little bit is going to be hard to cut. But things like increasing oil production, bringing the cost of oil down, remember, that goes into pretty much every product that you touch.
Yeah.
And so those will all be things that will help. You know, everyone thinks about gas prices. But we use so many more things that have oil in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's embedded in almost everything we produce, and even the service economy, because there's a cost associated with being mobile, traveling, and so forth. I said CPE, I meant PCE, of course, personal consumption expenditures. Well, but I think folks are expecting we're going to return to the pricing of the 2019 period.
Which is not going to happen.
Right.
Right. Prices are not going down. That's deflationary. If you want to talk about a problem for the government.
Big problem.
Have deflation, right? Because all of a sudden now you've got sales revenues, you know, tax revenues for the state are going down. It's going to push incomes down, which is going to push down income tax revenues. So you don't necessarily want the prices to go down a bunch because that would be deflationary, which would be catastrophic with the deficits that we have right now.
Yeah.
Right? The government actually needs a little bit of inflation to start to inflate away some of this deficit.
Yeah, that's a good point. So generally speaking, that would mean recession, massive job loss, people got less money in their pocket to spend. All that would be deflationary, but it's also a very bad economy,
a contracting economy. The only thing that would push prices down would be a recession, which would be bad.
Yeah. But you could see some, I mean, there are some commodities, there are some food commodities that are volatile, of course, that could come down and go up and come down. And if the cost of inputs, such as oil and energy, come down, that could be a factor in that.
It definitely helps, right? But you've still got rising wages.
Right.
And, you know, we've got a labor market that's softening a little bit, but it's still really strong.
And that's a major cost component, no matter what you're making, whether it's eggs or chickens or beef or other food products.
I mean, look, I went to the grocery store yesterday to pick up my last-minute things, well, pre-last-minute things for Thanksgiving, right? And I walked out, and I was like, that cart wasn't very full. That was $140.
I know. It's crazy. I really don't see how people do it. In fact, on the screen right now, price of eggs, November 24, $4.23. November 23, $2.43. Mm-hmm. So it's up substantially. But I got friends in that industry say bird flu and other things.
There were extraneous factors there that were causing that significant increase. I think we got up to $6 to $10 at one point. It was really crazy.
I mean, but it's subject to just classic demand and supply.
There's always, you know, some things that are going to go up and some things that are going to go down. But, like, think about a Coca-Cola. You know, think about going to the store and buying a 12-pack of Dr. Pepper's or Coke or Pepsi's, whatever your choice is. You know, those prices don't come down.
That's really right.
Yes, there are things that are going to be more volatile, that are more subject to commodity prices. But in general, what you see is, like, the core products that you're buying are not getting cheaper.
Markets, you optimistic?
So the trend is good right now. The party probably ends at some point. People are going to be surprised. But right now you've got a very strong market trend. You've got obviously a federal government that's coming in that's going to be much more, you know, pro-market.
Pro-business, yeah.
But you're sitting here in the 97th percentile all-time in valuations. So it's going to be imperative that corporate America continue to deliver on earnings. Otherwise, people might be a little bit surprised what can happen.
And they'll get punished if they miss, right?
Oh, it's going to be – if they miss, it's going to be bad.
Punished. I mean, NVIDIA got punished just because they only went up, what, 74% year-over-year in the quarter instead of the expectation of 100, right? Something crazy like that.
Expectations are high, so I think investors need to stay diversified, be patient.
But there's still lots of opportunity.
Absolutely. I think there's room to run here.
And the U.S. equity market is the greatest wealth producer in history. Thanks, Jeremy.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Gerard.
Be sure.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Appreciate Jeremy Nelson, partner at Element Wealth, for joining us in the Element Wealth studio. So I'll just say this again. Did you ever hear, Rhino, in the last 4 years, anybody in the Biden administration ever talk about economic growth? No. Always about, we got to take from this group and give it to that group. It's always just recutting the pie. I know I've said this multiple times, and I apologize for being repetitive, but it's a big thing because look at the markets reacting today, and I can just sense it. You talk to business folks out there, there's a sense of relief. Man, maybe we won't have a government that just seeks to make our lives difficult with stupid regulations and increased taxes and always blasting and smearing anyone that ever achieved any economic success. Now we have a government that supports that, that lauds it, that respects it, understands what it does for our economy. The past 4 years, you just make too much money. You got to send more to us because we're better managers of the economy than the market is.
And how many billions of dollars did the federal government set aside to build what? 7 charging stations?
I think it was 8 is the figure.
Oh, they're up to 8 now. They made it to a whopping 8.
No. 8 billion, pardon me.
Oh.
A little more than a billion per charging station, just as an example, which was pure ideological. That was not grounded in any economic logic. Purely ideological. Just like the crazy crap from the Treasury Department. Everybody's got to be committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, you're running the dang Treasury Department. And that was just one. What have we learned now? There are 428 agencies. Every one of them adopted this crap. Every one. Instead of addressing the things that people are most concerned about, such as the border and crime and inflation. Just incredible. So you got Janet Yellen, who was incompetent, in my view, and did a terrible job as a Treasury Secretary, being replaced by Scott Bessent. And honestly, she's leaving a mess behind her. And Scott Bessent's going to have to come in and clean it up because of the way that they handled the economy. Just mismanagement, just from the get-go. And something else that it gets a little wonky here, but the way she's been moving away from long-term debt to finance the shortfalls to shorter maturity securities, which essentially rolls over deficits with more and more Treasury bills instead of the normal way of issuing debt through 10- and 30-year maturities. I don't want to get too financially crazy, but that's bad management. That's good in the short term and bad in the long term. That's the bottom line of that approach. So now we got a new Treasury Secretary that's going to have to deal with that. And it's short term, again, marginally beneficial to consumers and taxpayers. Long term, it hurts them. It harms them. But again, this is just rooted in ideology, and I think Biden and company doing their dead level best to try to distract people about the inflation, as we've said. They actually witnessed with their eyes and their pocketbooks. So, big old thing that big change, and big changes are in store. And I applaud it. I welcome it. I think it's going to be great. You got Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. Honestly, they're going to be going to war with Washington. This is the bottom line. You got 3 million employees that are all concerned about their future, especially those that are still at home working. Well, no, they're still at home getting paid. I don't know if I could absolutely swear that they're working. This is going to be interesting to watch how that plays out. Now, they don't have the power to terminate people. Or hire people, or honestly enact any legislation or rules and regulations. But what they can do and what they will do is advise. And they'll advise Trump's pick to run the OMB. The name of that person escapes me. There's so dead gum many of them. have a hard time keeping up Office of Management budget. But that's who they're going to be working directly with, who, of course, works directly with the president. But make no mistake, Ramaswamy and Musk are going to be in the Oval Office a lot, working directly with the president. I don't think there's any question about that. And I look forward to that. Let's see, I'm still looking for OMB. It's so dead gum many of them, I can't keep up with them anymore. A lot of them kind of stick in my head. We'll find them in a minute. We're taking a break right now. We're in the Element Well studio. It's top of the hour. It's Fox News, Super Talk News. We're coming right back.
Of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher. Welcome to the show that challenges you to think deeply, and look beyond political posturing. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. Hour two of Middays is now live from the Element Well studio. It's Monday, so we're with you for 2 hours today, and then it's Ricky Matthews with Super Talk Outdoors at 12:05. Egg Bowl week is here all this week on Sports Talk Mississippi. You'll hear interviews with former Ole Miss and Mississippi State players, plus insight and analysis about this year's game. It's the annual game that defines the season, and it's one of the most colorful rivalries in all of sports. It's Egg Bowl Week, starting today at 3 p.m. on Sports Talk Mississippi, brought to you by Dee's Oil and Covington County Hospital. Yeah, disappointing for those of us who are among the Rebel fan nation, no doubt about it. The big game this past Saturday down in the swamp. So, Jackson Dart with a rather emotional press conference. Man, it's a tough deal, no doubt about it. Now you got all this money in this college athletics, and you got highly compensated coaches as well. I would say that's kind of ratcheted up the expectation, wouldn't you think?
Just a bit.
Yeah. So it's a different scenario when you're getting paid to play. I mean, that's part of the risk of it. You're just likely to receive more criticism. I don't engage. You know, I really don't. It is what it is. I get disappointed. It may be privately. I disagree with some things, but I'm not getting paid to do that. They are. Let the market dictate the outcome there and any changes, any adjustments, should there be any. I wouldn't support any at this point as an Ole Miss fan, honestly. But it's another situation where you just had extremely high expectations and you fell short of those, and you just got to regroup, keep going. Pretty much where we are. But we shall have the Egg Bowl. I can't remember it ever being on a Friday.
Yeah, I don't remember it ever being on a Friday. If it's not on Thanksgiving Day, it was usually the Saturday following.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
But in a storied history like the Egg Bowl, it would not surprise me if there was one or two games on a Friday.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I haven't
especially
researched.
In the earlier years where it was kind of all over the place, because, I mean, there were Egg Bowls played in, I want to say, Aberdeen and Tupelo, and many played in Jackson.
Yeah. I do remember many in Jackson. I witnessed a lot of those, that's for sure.
I'm fairly certain the ones in like Aberdeen and Tupelo were back in like the leather helmet days.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
When you could put it in your pocket, essentially, right? You could fold up your helmet up and put it in your dang pocket. I don't remember that. I guess Tupelo and Aberdeen, I didn't. But that's something. Well, that's all coming up. The market, by the way, the Dow up to up 335 points, I should say, at this moment.
Excuse me, not Aberdeen, Columbus.
Columbus, that makes more sense. I think I did hear that. The NASDAQ in the green up 51 points. What about your funny money? It's pulled back a little bit.
Yeah, and this is something Dave Hughes has talked a lot about when it comes to money and especially price and valuation. There's a part of human psychology that when you get close to big, round numbers, there's just something. It's like a soft barrier where it's going to take a little bit to get over that barrier, but once it does, then things return to normal. So it feels like that $100,000 valuation barrier is standing in between Bitcoin and it continuing its rise.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, you get what in the industry they call a level, a line of support, and you break through that line, then it could be a problem. But as long as you got a big line of support and you're kind of wavering around that.
Usually. Yeah, I found the list. Here we go. The Egg Bowl started. First one was in Starkville. Second one was in Starkville. Third one was in Oxford. Fourth one was in Columbus in 1904.
Wow.
Then it went to Jackson for some years. Then it went to Tupelo. Then it went back to Starkville and Oxford. Then it was played in Clarksdale in 1919. And then Greenwood in 20 and 21.
Clarksdale.
And then since then, it has either been Starkville, Oxford, or Jackson.
How about that? That's good info. Didn't know that. Well, the talking about Ramaswamy and Elon Musk, have you seen that Vivek has exposed IRS employees for not paying their taxes? I laugh because it's just so insane, so absurd. Thousands of IRS employees.
Yeah, there was some reporting on this in the lead up to the election, but it kind of got lost in all the political hoopla.
I want to say it was Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa who spearheaded that. And I guess she and her staff uncovered that there's some $50 million owed by IRS employees. You can't make it up, as they say. By the way, the government, why there are 3 million government employees in total, in aggregate, they owe $1.5 billion in unpaid taxes. These are probably the same people that think the rich don't pay their fair share, right? They're the ones that fall in line with that tired old talking point. I just was astonished when I dug into that to learn that that's actually true. It's just mind-boggling that that could even happen.
It's not just the people at the tippy top of the federal government pyramid that believe it's rules for thee but not for me.
That's exactly right. It extends all the way down through the org chart into the deep state of the swamp.
I mean, if you got your job just because you're some senator's daughter's boyfriend's dog walker's cousin-in-law, then of course you're not going to really think you have any expectations.
So true. So true. So, also, U.S. national debt hit a new record, $36 trillion and counting. $36 trillion. That's mind-boggling unto itself. The $35 trillion mark was hit just a few months ago, in July, already added a trillion since July of this year. That's unbelievable. So with a $1.8 trillion deficit and likely to repeat that even higher next year is what I would expect. Don't see any slowdown. You got the United States Post Office. They're struggling a bit as well. They lost $9.5 billion for fiscal year 24, they actually had a year-over-year growth in revenue, which is little surprising. And they did reduce expenses. They still lost $9.5 billion. A big contributor to that loss? Pensions. It's PERS on steroids is what it is here. Pensions. Unbelievable. They have a break-even goal. There was a 10-year plan to do so, and they're falling short of that here. And I think it's the first year of that 10-year plan. Maybe it's time we just dissolve, dismantle the United States Postal Service. And
I don't know that you want to completely dismantle it, but it's definitely top-heavy and unwieldy.
Yeah. It
could definitely be made more efficient.
Well, the pensions are a big drag and have been. I mean, this isn't anything new. They've been losing money for years. Multiple billion-dollar losses, multi-billion-dollar losses for years. And, again, you could trace much of that to their pensions. But we're picking up the tabs. Bottom line is the taxpayers are having to cover these losses. Another loss that taxpayers look like they might be on the hook to cover is the result of some COVID money in California. Please tell the folks about that.
Oh, yeah. The state of California was one of 22 or 23, I forget the number, it's been a while now, the state governments that received federal funding, federal loans, to shore up their unemployment because of the sharp increase of people filing unemployment during COVID. Well, in the last year and a half, California's decided, you know what? We're just not going to make any more payments on that loan to the federal government. We're just not going to put any money aside in our budget to make those payments. And, well, now they're getting towards the point of default. And I'm not a lawyer, but apparently federal law requires that if you default on a loan to the state, the state's businesses pick up the tab in the form of federal taxes.
That's crazy. You ever heard that? Coming right back in the Element Well studio.
Three.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's do it.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. Dan in Hattiesburg, we were talking about, what'd you call it, the Peach Book?
Plum Book.
Plum Book. The Plum Book, and then the Fed has the Beige Book. Well, Dan in Hattiesburg said Clinton had a Black Book. So I was discussing earlier about a number of President-elect Trump's picks being contributors well known for their appearances on Fox News. It's a bunch of them. So I thought we might not have a Fox News by the time it's all over with on the C Spire text line. Gutfeld will still be there. It's probably true. Trump has to put someone in office so he can fire them, says Keith in Vaden. This appointment is payback for the labor unions not endorsing anyone this election, says Scott Clinton. Well, payback to who, though, Scott? I don't, at this point, just based on the history of this individual who's been appointed, the rep out of Washington State, she has a history of being very pro-union, I would say, anti-market, anti-labor, and all you have to do is consider that she got rousing praise upon her being named from the labor unions. And that caused me certainly to kind of take it back and caused a bit of concern. What does that mean to labor in this country? I'm not sure where that one came from. And it's certainly something that we'll keep an eye on. Representative Lori Chavez de Rimmer. I think that's how you pronounce it. Had anybody even heard of her before this? I don't know that we've ever covered anything related to her. So the unions really like her. And as soon as I see the unions like her, especially the crazy, radical, egregious teachers' unions who really are hostile to parents and seek to indoctrinate the nation's children with their radical leftist ideology, that concerns me. But we'll see. You know, like I said, I'm willing to give it a chance and see the line of questioning that we will see, we will witness in the Senate, and how she responds to those questions. Certainly, Rhino, you would expect she'll be asked about her support of the PRO Act. I mean, that's on the record. One of three Republicans, I believe, that did so. So certainly counter to her party, the vast majority of her party. It's just interesting. And then just some of her past statements, policy positions on labor in this country. We'll see where that goes.
Gary, I actually found a guide of all the different color books from the federal government.
Okay.
So we've talked about the Plum Book, the United States Government Policy and Supporting Positions, with the over 7,000 different leadership and support positions that have to be filled.
Yep.
You've got the Orange Book, Approved Drug Products with Therapeutic Equivalence Evaluations, published by the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Red Book, Principles of Federal Appropriations Law, published by Government Accountability Office. You've got the Yellow Book, Government Auditing Standards. I wonder how often that one gets picked up. And the Green Book, Background Material and Data on the Programs Within the Jurisdiction of the Committee on Ways and Means. Boy, that sounds like a page-turner. Oh, and the Pink Book, Epidemiology and Prevention of Vaccine-Preventable Diseases.
Oh, there you go.
And then, just as added bonus, every state, which I think we had somebody on the text line mention this, every state has a blue book that is generally a government manual issued by state governments or legislatures, but that's not to be confused with Project Blue Book, which was the federal government investigating UFOs back in the 40s through the 60s.
So, there's a history, right? There's a history around the colors being assigned to the books. I mean, there's something. What is it exactly? Like, where do they come up with, what'd you say, peach?
Well, you've got, we talked about the beige book with the Federal Reserve. You got the yellow book, the plum book, the green book, the pink book, the blue book, the orange book, and the red book.
I mean, the beige book, I believe, was beige.
Yes.
I mean, at the time, it was a...
Yeah, all the colors come from the cover of the book.
Okay. Just making sure that that was the case. So, okay. Well, that's interesting, and I had no idea there was that many, that's for sure, but there's a bunch of them. Man, that's crazy. 428, I'm still trying to wrap my head around 428 different agencies. I can't, and Musk and Ramaswamy says, yeah, we can get that down to, we think we can get that down to 99. So that's, which would be significant. You got, at the federal government level, you've got a lot of talk about eliminating the Department of Education, and that's something that the president-elect discussed on the campaign trail. He made that a core component of his agenda.
And it's just anecdotal, but talking to different people from different generations, it feels like the older generations, those that are maybe old Gen X into the baby boomer generation and older, have a different viewpoint of the federal government than the younger generations.
Yeah.
I'm hearing more from the older generations that they don't necessarily agree with dissolving the Department of Ed, that there needs to be some sort of federal standard. Meanwhile, the younger generations are looking at it going, that thing's barely older than I am, and we've had worse problems since they got going. Maybe try a different route. The federal government's not there to save you.
Yeah.
It just feels like there's a difference between generations on belief in the federal government.
I think that's right. There's an attitude about it that's totally different than it was in the past. And I don't know. We'll see kind of what happens on that. So the state of Mississippi gets a whole bunch of money from the federal government. In fact, the ratio of the amount we receive to the amount we send is about 3-1. That, unfortunately, is the highest in the country, and that's because we're the poorest state in terms of household income, per capita income, poverty in general. So we qualify for a whole lot more money. If I'm not mistaken, Rhino, this last year, about $14 billion we got, $14, $15 billion from the federal government. Now, that comes in many forms and, it, you know, covers lots of different areas. Education, of course, receives a fair amount of money, and that's a question that a lot of people have is, okay, if we eliminated the Department of Education, does that mean we're eliminating all federal money that goes to the states from the Department of Education for education? I don't know. I mean, eliminating the department, does that just consist of stripping the federal government out of education policy at the state level and just the operations of the educational system at the state level? Or does it mean we ain't sending you any more money? I'm not really sure. The total amount sent to the states, about $120 billion from the federal government. That's about $2,400 per pupil, which is really incredible. $120 billion came from the federal government, distributed to the states, $2,400 per pupil. The amount that goes to the state of Mississippi from the federal government, I'd have to do a little math on that to determine it. Let's see. It looks like it's, best I can tell, about $3 billion. I don't know if you're looking at that the way I am, but I think that's about right. About $3 billion comes from the federal government.
Yeah, the Department of Education for Mississippi received $3.312 billion in the 24-25 budget.
Okay. The state, of course, you understand that education is receives money, public education, from the state, and then a good bit of that is funded at the local level as well. That's what you pay your property taxes, your ad valorem taxes. You see the distribution on the bills you receive for your car tag, for your property taxes, and you see how much goes to the school district in which you live. So the combined state and municipal is about $10 billion. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So total of about $15 billion on education in Mississippi, of which $3 billion comes from the federal government. So it's not clear whether or not we would completely lose that or not if the federal government shut down the Department of Education. We're stepping aside for a break. Coming right back.
From Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
So we're trying to figure out how much we spend on education and how much comes from the Fed, from the state, from the local governments. Rhino and I have been doing math calculations on the break there. So it looks like we spend right under $6 billion total, right? Is kind of what I'm looking at, of which just under $3 comes from the state.
Yeah, if you look at the reported per pupil expenditures, and then multiply that by the total number of students enrolled in public schools, K through 12,
yeah,
you wind up with, depending on the source of the amount spent per pupil, anywhere from just shy of $5 billion to just shy of $6
billion. Right. But what's a little confusing is that you found the same number I did, about $3 billion coming from the Fed, right? You see that? You're looking at the Department of Ed's website. Is that right? Is that where you got that? Okay. Yeah, so they're reporting that, and I was looking at just a couple of think tanks' reports, you know, on education spending in the country, and they both agree it's about $3 billion from the Fed. That's kind of the main thing we're focused on is what happens to that. I would also add that, and that's something that our state and all states are going to have to keep in mind if in fact, the federal government is going to start slashing the budgets of some of these agencies, especially such as the Department of Ed, which oversees lots of money sent down to the states. And if that money starts to decrease based on these new policies, and that puts more financial responsibility at the state level. Now, I actually support that. I think the Fed should pare down its spending, especially that which is going to the states, which the states just then use to operate various programs. Another big example that, which would be the biggest example, honestly, is Medicaid, as far as a program that is funded jointly between the federal government and the state governments. And that's a massive amount that states receive. It's $616 billion a year. Compare that to education, which is $119 billion. So the Medicaid program is 5.2x in terms of federal spending that education is. But the state of Mississippi receives $6 billion a year from the federal government to operate the Medicaid program. And it's a match that's based on the per capita income of the state. Because we have the lowest, we get the most money from the federal government. We essentially are, in many ways, you could view us as a welfare state that is highly reliant on money from the federal government. And that should be something we seek to change, to reform. It means that our state's economy is growing, that our folks are making more money, and we're less reliant on these welfare programs. And just money from the federal government to operate public education, which is not a welfare program in my view, but it still supplies a good chunk of the funding, does the federal government, to run the K-12 education system in the state of Mississippi. But you and I were talking about this in our meeting this morning. There is some information that's starting to float out there about reforms to the Medicaid program with the incoming president, Dr. Mehmet Oz, overseeing the CMS program. This, of course, would for the most part require legislation that passes the Congress, gets signed by the president, but significant reform of that program could place a financial hardship on the states, and in particular the state of Mississippi. So one thing that's being discussed is reducing the federal match. So the problem with the Medicaid program right now, this is kind of crazy for most people, I think, that probably don't know that's how it works, is it's not like there's a budget that says, here's how much we're spending at the federal government on Medicaid on an annual basis. It's not the way it works. There are guidelines, extremely complicated guidelines, handed down to the states that say, this is how you operate your Medicaid program and the requirements you have to satisfy. You have some latitude, states, where you can make some adjustments. But for the most part, no matter what you do, you got to, at a minimum, do X. And that X is a giant stack of regulations. But it doesn't say, this is all I'm sending you, Mississippi. No, the way it works is the claims are filed, And the federal government pays its 78% in Mississippi, and the state of Mississippi pays its 22%. And so we really don't know on an annual basis. We can guess, forecast, project, predict, but it's not like, hey, once we run out of money for Medicaid, that's it. No, the federal government just pays those claims, and the state of Mississippi pays its part for those claims. So it's kind of on autopilot. It's, again, it's not limited. Medicare, same way. Social Security, same way. Those are statutory programs. There's not a budget, per se. I mean, you could produce a budget to try to project, like I said, but it's not one that has a cap on it. We can't spend any more than that, same as Medicare. It's based on the claims. So where I'm going with this is something that's been discussed. Man, I started talking about this, don't mind telling you, in 2013 when I did a split-screen debate on the issue of Medicaid expansion, I was generally opposed to it, and the person I debated was for it. This was on Mississippi Public Television. And I suggested then what we should do is just forget this coverage group and that coverage group and expansion and all that stuff. Just block grant it to the states and let the states run the program the way they see fit. They pick who's eligible for coverage and what the criteria are to be covered. They then determine how much would be paid, which would be a combination of money appropriated by the state plus the block grant. But that block grant comes from the federal government, and it is a fixed amount. So it's way more predictable and way easier to manage at the federal level. Here's how much you get, states. Don't come crawling back for more. This is all you get. You got to cover. So that's an issue for the state of Mississippi in the current program. Forget expansion. The other thing that's being discussed is this 90% match, and this has always been a concern of people. Anytime you talk about expanding that 90% of the expansion coverage group, that was included in the legislation, the Affordable Care Act, that essentially established Medicaid expansion, or qualified able-bodied adults is the coverage group with an income below 138% of the federal poverty level to be enrolled in Medicaid. So what they're talking about, which by the way gets reimbursed from the federal government at 90%, what's being discussed is we're just going to pull that back to the standard FMAP. Well, there goes the incentive for the 10 states, the financial incentive for the 10 states that have yet to expand.
It's likely going to be a bear to deal with for the states that have expanded.
They would be on the hook for the difference between their FMAP and 90%. And some of those wealthier states, they get like 55, 60%. It wouldn't be as big a cross to bear financially for the state of Mississippi, though we haven't expanded, because it's 12% difference between our standard FMAP and the 90% enhanced. But to a wealthy state like a Connecticut that I think gets like 55, 60%, I think the minimum is 50 according to federal law, that'd be a big deal for them, a state that has expanded.
Which they're not doing too hot economically, because if I'm not mistaken, they're another one of those states that has just not paid back their unemployment loan from the federal government.
Okay, I didn't know that. So they got.
I think there's three or four states out of the 22 or 23 that just haven't paid it back yet.
What a dang mess. So you got possibly ending the enhanced match for expansion. You got possibly reducing the current amount of money we get from the federal government. And again, reforming it to be allocated to the state as a block grant. And so you got a federal government, this incoming federal government that says, we got to start cutting somewhere. You guys want, and we all do, we want to see the deficit begin to come down, pull back. We're tired of adding all this money to the debt. We got to cut it somewhere. And the president's already said we're not touching Social Security and Medicare, and we got debt interest. So that leaves you with only about 40% of the total federal spending you can even address. Medicaid is about 11, 12% of that. I think I said it last week, I'd actually support an idea where the federal government just ended the Medicaid program and just said, look, states, you're on your own. You want to cover people the way Medicaid covers them now? You fund it. You operate it. It would be a hardship on the state of Mississippi to the tune of about $6 billion, which is six-sevenths of our total general fund spending today. I know a lot of people say, hey, look, this is a matter for churches and charitable organizations. Okay, here's your chance, $6 billion. We're stepping aside for a break, coming right back with the final segment on this Monday. Stay with us.
Again.
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
We are back in the Element Well studio. So I've said before that I really thought the passing of the American Rescue Plan, ARPA, as it is known commonly, is really what ignited this inflation monster. Vox, who's kind of left-leaning, I think it's fair to say, media source, had an article saying that exact thing this weekend. I was shocked. They came out and denounced, said that Biden ignored inflation and it cost the Democrats politically. And the first thing that they said that was the mistake they made was the American Rescue Plan was much too big. I say it was too big. If it was a penny, it was unnecessary and too big. So something I learned in reading that piece, Rhino, is that originally they wanted a $2.4 trillion bill and had to settle for a $1.9 trillion. Settle for that. White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, Schumer, et cetera, they were all involved. I didn't know in this process back in 21, first big piece of legislation that came out of the Biden administration. But basically the article, I was shocked because these guys are typically unfriendly to the right and friendly to the left. The article title, Biden screwed up on inflation. -badly. Where you been, Vox? Because you've been praising every economic policy that's been issued for the last 3 3/4 of a year. Where you been? So now you're waking up. Yeah, that American Rescue Plan, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Wow. On the C Spire text line, of course, Thomas and Greenwood, who is obsessed with the Medicaid program. You ever been in a Medicaid clinic, Thomas? Just curious. I have. So we shouldn't expand Medicaid and increase federal dependency. Well, there's something I want to point out, and I get it. It is a welfare program, there's no doubt. But just keep this in mind. The money goes to the people who provide the services. Doesn't go to the patient. It goes to the physician, the hospital, the clinic, the nurses. That's what it goes to. Unfortunately, our federal government says you have to take care of those people, but you can't get paid. We're not paying you. It's free. It's got to be free. And what I mean by that is if someone shows up and they're uninsured, they show up at an ER, they're going to get taken care of by law. And if they don't, man, the hospital would shut down, unfortunately. So the question is, how do we deal with this conundrum? I say send Medicaid to the states and repeal EMTALA. That's the law passed under Ronald Reagan, that requires hospitals to stabilize, ER stabilize. Anybody that comes in, got to stabilize them. You can't say, hey, can you pay? And they're having a heart attack, and they say, no, I don't have insurance, and I don't have any money. Oh, sorry, you just have to die. We don't do that in this country. Since that law was passed in 1986, signed into law by Ronald Reagan. So the question is, that's not true, Thomas. You're wrong about that. If they participate in the Medicare program, EMTALA requires them to stabilize patients. You find a hospital other than a specialty hospital that only serves the more affluent population, they have to. They're required by law. They would be owned by the patient's family if they didn't. But it doesn't. No, they don't have to accept Medicaid. You didn't hear me, Thomas. Medicare. Rhino, do you know a hospital that doesn't accept Medicare? You're shaking your head. No.
No.
No. Right. Exactly. You don't listen. So the problem is, how do we deal with this situation? Again, I say send it back to the states. Let the states deal with it. Okay, that means, and get rid of that $616 billion out of the budget. Now we're really taking an axe to the federal largesse. We got a $1.92 trillion deficit. I like the idea. Now, you'd have to phase it in. I talked to some doctors about this over the weekend. Man, they're scratching their heads. There, you know this, Rhino. There's some hospitals, even I know one locally in our area here, almost all Medicaid now. Almost all Medicaid. Delivering babies. Because I think the last statistic I looked at, is it like 70% of the babies in Mississippi are born to under the Medicaid program, right? 70%. It's insane.
If not a higher percentage, yeah.
If not a higher one, right. It's insane. We've got to change these cultural problems. I'm just going to say it. And people may get mad about that and label me with all kinds of pejoratives. That's fine. It's a cultural problem. Is it not? It absolutely is. We've got to change that.
Way too many people are more worried about, I'm going to get mine.
Yep. Yep.
Everybody else be damned.
Yep. Exactly right. That's what's dragging us down. It's dragging our state down. It's dragging our economy down. Somebody said earlier about the labor force participation rate. How much does federal funding contribute to that? I'm going to say again, I have zero confidence in the federal government's labor force participation rate. And I'll pose this question once again, as I do every time I go out and speak. Has anybody here ever been called by the Bureau of Labor Statistics when they're collecting data to calculate that labor force participation rate? I've yet to find a single person in the state of Mississippi who's ever been called. I don't think they do. They make it up. We're coming. Oh, we're back with you again tomorrow. We're out of time. Stay safe.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.